Welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guest is Linda Orkin. Orkin has been an active docent with the Cornell Lab of Ornithology's outreach program since 2008 and has served as coordinator of this program, scheduling docents to lead weekend walks at Sapsucker Woods in Ithaca. Orkin is also an active member of the Cuga Bird Club and served as president from 2011 to 2013 and is currently vice president. She is the co-coordinator of the Christmas Bird Count and has been involved with creating the club's conservation committee. And welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Tish. I'm glad to have this opportunity.
Now, tell us what it was that captured your imagination about birds and all things birds.
What is it that captures everybody's imagination about birds? I think it's really the same thing for everybody that takes time to notice that we are constantly surrounded by birds. So birds are just a part of our natural world that we don't have to really seek out. Just walk down the street, walk down the commons. Anywhere you are, there are birds who are living their lives, singing beautifully, and doing things that we can relate to and that we can understand. If you think about mammals, we have very little experience with mammals. They mostly are active at night. We don't see them. Birds are out during the day. Mammals are mostly hidden from us. They've learned to do that very well. But birds are part of the sky. So they can't really hide from us. They're just out there and they're part of what we do. They're in trees as we walk by, and they are actively displaying for many reasons, to defend a territory and to attract a mate. While they're doing these beautiful displays, we, of course, are also noticing them. So if you just take a moment to tune into the natural world, you will become aware of birds. Yeah. As you become aware of birds, you will become more and more aware of the natural world, because everything that they do relies on what is happening in that natural world, including seasons, which is happening now, migration, and including the health of our environment, including things that we can do for them, like feed them at our feeders. So they are an intimate part of our lives. And I think probably have been for humans since we could notice things.
But you know what? I know a lot of people who say, why is it that people want a bird watch? You know, of course they're aware of them, but you guys take things a few steps further by studying them and going out and watching them every weekend.
I mean, I think
it's amazing.
It presupposes that you already have a basic interest in nature, which I think we probably all do, but many of us don't take the time for that.
Yeah.
So if you are willing to be drawn in, birds are really a way in. But it really does presume from the beginning that you will be willing to listen to what they have to say to us. I've been out at the Plantations Arboretum walking, and there was in one tree a Baltimore Oriole, a rose-breasted grosbeak, and a robin all singing at the same time.
Wow, a chorus.
Now, to me, it didn't take a bird watcher or a listener to tune into that, but everybody was just walking by without any knowledge that these birds are up there doing that. It would have just taken 1 second for a person to point this out to them, and they would have instantly become amazed and interested in this.
So,
what I feel is that if you're not already interested in birds, it's just because somebody hasn't introduced you to them.
That makes sense to me.
That's how I feel, anyway.
So you've been involved with Cornell's Lab of Ornithology for quite a few years as a docent.
Right.
To tell us what kind of training you had to go through to become one.
This was very interesting because the Lab of Ornithology, although in its conception, it's a visitor center. Mm-hmm. Basically, it's a research center. So they have this beautiful building, but they really never had people that were trained and managed to invite the public in. So the new building opened in 2003, and they hired a manager of the visitor center, Charles Eldermeyer, whom I'm very grateful to, but he no longer does this. He had the idea to start a volunteer program, which there really wasn't before either. And he sent out emails to people that are on our listserv, our bird listserv in the area, asking if anybody would be interested in doing outreach. So in the very beginning, there was no training required at all, just interest in birds. And there were a lot of possible things that we could do. We could help to band birds. We could help to observe nests in the woods. But really, the main thing it turned out to be was leading bird walks. And we didn't all know that in the beginning. But so the training for me involved, I had taken Springfield Ornithology, which is a course that's been offered here in Ithaca for, I think it's 27 years now. By Steve Kress. And have you heard about this, Tish, at all?
No, I don't think I have.
So this is everybody's big introduction into the world of birds in Ithaca, and we are so fortunate to have this here. It's a 6-week course that actually just started last week. It's Wednesday night lectures at the Lab of Ornithology, and then weekend field trips, really going quite far afield. In past years have gone to Cape May, but this year they're going to Ohio for one of their big weekends for birding. So I did this class in 1990, already having been interested in birds, but not really knowing all the birds that could be seen in our area. I mean, at Sapsucker Woods alone, there's been over 200 species of birds tallied.
Oh, it's amazing.
I know.
You know, when I moved here from California, I couldn't believe all the birds here.
It's very,
birds
very
that I
amazing.
Thought were mythical, like bluebirds.
I know. It's really amazing.
Yeah, it's amazing.
We're in a really nice area for birds. We are on a flyaway between Chesapeake Bay and St. James Bay. The lake stays open all winter. Even this winter when the Great Lakes froze, our lake still stayed open.
Yeah,
so we have all kinds of ducks here. And Sapsucker Woods is a really good place for birds. So we have this great resource of good birds here. We have this other great resource of great birders here who are willing to teach people. So I kind of had this very basic grounding in birds, done a lot of birding on my own. And then when this opportunity came along, I made it my point to bird frequently at Sapsucker Woods. And every time people would ask me questions, I would go back home and research that.
Ah, so do you have a real particular interest in really knowing everything, don't you?
Yeah, I do.
It's great.
When I'm leading these bird walks, people are hungry to see the birds, but what they're more hungry for are to learn about the birds.
Yeah.
They really want to know what are the birds doing, and I really want them to understand that the birds are also thinking while they're doing. This is not just instinctive behavior. They actually learn. They learn their songs. They learn what they're doing. They learn how to survive. So I really want people to see these birds as individuals with a lifestyle that we can impact in good and bad ways, and to really kind of see into their lives to really appreciate that it's not just an ornament, but it's a life.
As somebody who's been watching birds for so many years, have you ever particularly been able to follow one that you knew was the same one from birth to...
You know, that's not an easy thing to do because...
I would assume not, yeah.
Normally they have to be tagged or banded for you to be able to follow them. And in order to do that legally, you have to be a licensed band birder and you have to have a particular study.
You can't just
say, I wonder what the birds in my yard are doing.
Uh-huh.
The Fish and Wildlife Service won't give you a permit for that. You have to say, you have to be a scientist, you have to be trained, and you have to say, you know, do the blue jays in my yard, is it the same ones in the winter that it is in the summer? You know, you have to have a particular study. But I've been lucky in some ways because I had a flock of crows that were coming to my platform feeder, and one of the crows had white feathers in place of some black feathers.
Oh, yeah.
So I was able to know him intimately and know that he was with his family. And one other crow of that flock had an injured leg, so I got to know her also. And then we have researchers in Ithaca that band babies at the nest. So they actually banded one of the babies of this flock. So I had the white-winged crow, I had the crippled crow, and I had the tagged crow.
The crippled crow.
Yeah.
Is that a new species, Linda?
I thought it was her foot, but Kevin told me it was actually her hip. She couldn't put her leg down over.
You know, we had a turkey like that had an injured leg, and it came back every time.
I know, so you could recognize that turkey, too.
We called her, her different names.
And didn't you feel kind of a particular affection for her?
Oh,
when
we
you kind
did.
Of know her?
Oh, we absolutely
I know.
Did. Oh, God. So, we called her Gilda.
Interesting. Does she still come around?
Well, we haven't seen her this season, but last season she did.
Well,
she's come
she
a couple of times, yeah.
I hope she does.
Now, let's talk also about the Cuga Bird Club, of which you are the vice president.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us what that club does that's maybe different than the Lab of Ornithology. I know you guys work together.
I mean, the thing, we're intimately associated, but I wouldn't really say that we even really work together. I think we kind of work in parallel ways. The Bird Club is really there to really bring the public into watching birds. I would say almost every weekend of the year.
Mm.
We have frequent field trips that are run during the year. Plus, as I said, we do now sponsor the weekend bird walks at Sapsucker Woods. So our goal is to, I think the best way to say it is to foster conservation through knowledge, I think would be my emphasis. Other people might say something different, that they just like to look at birds. But I really feel that the whole three-dimensionality of it is that you get to know birds, you get to love them, and then you get to care about what happens to them and why, which involves conservation.
Does the club actually get involved in conservation issues?
So we just did start this conservation committee 2 years ago, and even though in the past we had been involved in writing letters to legislators about certain issues that we cared about, and then whenever something came along, like we have a panel up at Myers Point that explains birds that come there that the club did, we had, originally when it was founded in 1913, that were very, very active in conservation at the time.
Wow.
They would have hundreds of people showing up at Stewart Park, even hundreds of school children showing up to put up bird boxes and bird feeders. But times are so different now. There's so many competing activities, and we just don't get those kind of numbers. But our conservation committee is quite active. Last year, we put up several trail of bird boxes up at Salt Point, which is near Myers Point.
Mm-hmm.
So bluebird boxes, tree swallow boxes, screech owl nest, I can't remember what else. Great-crested flycatcher. So there's a trail of nest boxes that go around. We're hoping to do more of that. Even at Sapsucker Woods, they need help with their bird boxes there because they don't have enough kind of maintenance people to do that.
Yeah,
so we're hoping
to
do that this year. In addition, our conservation committee right now is working on the impact of bird strikes at Cornell when birds fly into glass buildings, especially during migration. So we have volunteers right now going out in the mornings on Mondays and Friday mornings to look around some of the buildings in North Campus and West Campus to see what kind of birds we can find that might have flown into the buildings at night.
And so what do you do about that, though?
So then, if they're still alive, we can bring them to the wildlife clinic. If they're dead, we'll just tally them and then bring them to the lab. The lab has a skin collection, and anybody that finds a dead bird can bring it to the lab.
But what about prevention, though?
So prevention, do they do something that's the different? Other thing. The American Bird Conservancy has many guidelines for how to prevent bird strikes.
I see.
So
mm-hmm.
we're hoping to work with facilities at Cornell, if we find buildings that are a particular problem, to see what ways we can ameliorate that. As a matter of fact, we just got an email from somebody yesterday down in the Arnett Medical Center, and he said there's a glass elevator tower right by his office, and there was a berry-bearing tree right nearby, and cedar waxwings were all flying into this.
Oh, that's such tragedy.
Yeah, so our conservation committee chairperson wrote some suggestions to him, but probably can't be implemented immediately, but maybe even just to hang some banners from the tree.
Yeah, something to distract.
Because they see it just as a continuation of the outdoors.
Yeah. So, I also want to talk to you about the annual Christmas bird count. Well, what's the point of that? What's
this has
the
been going
necessity
on.
Of this?
This is administered by Audubon Society, and it's been going on for 115th year coming up in January.
Wow.
And it's so a continuous study of birds for 115 years. Now, the count only happens once a year, and it's in the winter. But, of course, for some areas, it goes down even to South America now. So for some areas, it's their summer, and it's their birds that are birds that are down there. So we go out. Each club or area can pick a day from December 15th to January 4th that they want to count. Ours is always January 1st, which is good because it's a holiday. And we spend the day going out counting birds in our area. Everybody takes a little parcel of it, count the birds, and then we tally them at the end of the day. And all that's submitted to Audubon. And they tally the whole thing, and they've been doing that for 115 years.
So are they trying to measure what?
They're trying to measure everything. They're trying to measure changes. They're trying to measure
populations,
population, range changes, how they're moving further north, where they're declining. A lot of interesting information has been picked up from the Christmas bird count, for example, that rusty blackbirds are declining, or that snow geese are becoming a problem maybe down in the Chesapeake Bay in the winter. You know, different things like that are learned from this. But it's the continuity of the study that's really so amazing and so helpful, and the fact that it's becoming more and more widespread, so it's going to be more and more useful over time. But I would love to see there's always attempts to do them in the spring, but they never seem to last. When I first started birding in the 90s, they started a North American migration count, which was happening in May. But somehow that never really caught hold. So
sometimes I used to think it was just for fun.
Well,
but it's really valuable information.
It started out really as a counterpoint to people used to go out Christmas morning and shoot everything they could see.
Oh,
so Frank Chapman started this Christmas bird count. He said, why don't we just go out and count things?
Instead of kill them.
Yeah, so
what a unique idea,
It was actually quite unique at the time.
It must have been.
It really was.
Yeah.
I mean, he probably got a lot of flack from people, I have to say. Although he did get a lot of people on board with him, but I'm sure a lot of people said,
If you're just joining us, my guest is Linda Orkin. She's the vice president of the Cuga Bird Club. You know what I want to ask you, too? What kind of tips would you give people who maybe for the first time in their lives want to put up feeders? Is there any particular steps they should take?
Some recommendations so the birds don't fly into your windows is to put feeders as close as possible to your house, really. So then they know that there's a building there. Like if it's within, I think it's within 10 feet. But I can recommend that you go to the Lab of Ornithology website, the Cornell Lab of Ornithology, because there will be recommendations there under All About Birds, where to put feeders. Cornell runs a lot of citizen science projects. One of them is Nest Watch. So if you get in touch with the Lab of Ornithology, talk to Nest Watch. They will really be able to help you figure out where's a good place to put your feeders.
You know, that's really interesting, you know, because the tendency was always, especially when I was a kid, to put it right in the window.
Right.
Bird, you know.
Right.
So you can look out your window.
Because birds will get used to you being there. It may take them a little longer to come to your feeder if it's closer to your house than if it's a little further away, but once they do, they're not going to be afraid of you.
Yeah.
So it's a good thing to know the closer to your house, the better. And then there's a variety of seeds that are recommended, but black oil sunflower seeds is kind of the best overall seed for all birds. Even mourning doves love grain, but I've noticed that the mourning doves will even eat the sunflower seeds. So it's because it's got a very soft shell, so most birds can manage it, and it's very high in oil, which is good for them.
Yeah.
Doesn't it really just connect you so much with what's going on, too?
Especially it does.
As the birds are migrating through. Some of them will just stop by your feeder for a day, like an indigo bunting might show up at your feeder that never, ever see.
I know.
Otherwise.
We saw some red-winged blackbirds yesterday, and we were so excited. And it was most magical thing is 2 years we've had bluebirds nesting. We put up a new bluebird house.
That is so nice.
It was so magical. It's like a Disney film out there.
I know.
The deer and the bluebird.
No, it is. It's great.
It really is quite an amazing thing.
I just think it really just opens up our heart to what they're doing and how they're surviving. I mean, on the coldest morning of the winter this year, which was pretty darn cold, you could still get up and see chickadees seeming very cheery. I'm sure that they weren't all that cheery, but just coming to your feeder, grabbing a seed and flying up in a tree. It's amazing that they can survive those nights, that they still wake up in the morning and they're all set to go. I mean,
And in bird songs,
I know.
Traditionally, through the ages, it's been the sign of the earth coming back to life.
Do you know bird songs at all? Because that's like the best part of birding for me. I just love
I wouldn't be able to imitate. Yeah. Do you know how to do bird calls?
I can't imitate them, but I love to listen to them. I mean, as soon as, because like our resident birds, like the cardinals and the titmice and chickadees, they start singing as soon as the days start getting longer, in January even. These cold, sunny mornings, you hear a cardinal song ringing out in your neighborhood.
Oh, it's wonderful.
I know, it really is.
It is magical. So, and we are so ready for spring right now.
I know.
Here in the
Finger Lakes. I'm sure they all are. The poor robins, they all arrived. I mean, we have robins that stay over the winter. Some people don't know that, but we still have robins that migrate in. And I don't know if everybody noticed, but about 3 or 4 weeks ago, we had a big influx of robins. But then the ground was still snow covered with ice. And
I know. And you know what? When I see robins in the winter, I think, what's wrong with them?
Yeah, because migration is a dangerous thing to do.
Oh, it is. Yeah.
So if you can find enough food to stay where you are, you're better off. So they can switch their diet to lots of berries in the winter. If they can find even little patches of muddy creek bed or whatever, they can look for all kinds of invertebrates. They're very good at it.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really better to not migrate if you don't have to. But like our little warblers, they live only on insects. So there's not enough insects for them.
Yeah,
and mostly like flying or leaf insects.
Yeah.
Chickadees find lots of insects in the winter, but they're all like hibernating insects in the tree bark. Warblers don't do that. So
you know what I want to ask you too? The importance, I've been told that it's very important if you do put up a bird feeder that you should keep filling it up.
That's really kind of a myth, really.
Is it? That's what I wanted to ask you about.
For most birds, it's much better, especially for a very cold snap, if you keep your feeder filled up because it's a lot easier for them to get the food there. But your feeder is probably just one stop on a kind of a whole array of feeder activities that they have during a day. They'll go to neighborhood feeders, and they still eat a lot of natural food. So they are not all just sitting
totally
on your porch just saying, okay, if Tish doesn't bring out the seed, I'm just going to die here. They're not doing
they're
that.
Smarter
they're
smarter than that, right?
Yeah, they're saying, uh-oh, Tish didn't fill up the feeder today. Let me go like three houses down and get a couple of things there. Or let me go to that dead tree over in the corner of the yard and get some, grubs out of that. So they really know what they're doing.
Well, that'll make a lot of people happy when they forget to do it.
Yeah, it's a good thing. I mean, it definitely makes it easier for a chickadee because on a very cold day, they need to eat like 200 sunflower seeds a day to get through the night.
Wow.
So it's certainly easier if they're just zooming in and out. But if you watched one chickadee, he's not going to stay at your feeder all day long no matter what. And he's not hasn't stopped eating. He's just gone someplace else to see what the other offerings are. Probably, I would say, in any natural animal's mind, this whole idea of a variety of diet is also part of what is good eating for them.
Yeah.
They don't just want to eat the same thing.
So humans should take that to heart,
it's a good
too,
lesson.
Because a lot of people get into the habit of having pizza every day or something,
I mean, I've read a book. If you watch cows grazing out in a natural field, they'll take all different kinds of plant material. They're not just going to eat the grass. They're going to look for cow purslane. I'm not even sure what they are, but different plants. And birds are the same. They want a varied diet.
Do birds just feed and eat during the daylight hours, or are they doing it at night?
Except for something like an owl, which is feeding during the night on birds. So birds have to be really quiet at night. They don't even want to be disturbed because owls are watching to see if they even rustle their feathers to settle themselves in. An owl can see that and grab a bird. So they actually have just recently been doing feeder studies with chickadees, and they're finding that they stop feeding around 2 hours before dark. And they were like, well, this doesn't really make sense. Why don't they just keep on feeding? And they decided that the pressure from screech owl predation is so strong that chickadees would much rather be in their little roost hole or snuggled against a tree trunk long before it gets dark so that a screech owl won't find them.
Wow.
So owls are very good predators at night, but birds are generally quiet. They really can't see at night.
Uh-huh.
Pretty much like us.
I see. Oh, that's really interesting.
Yeah, they don't have a lot of, they have really mostly color vision. They don't have a lot of the night vision apparatus, so they don't. I mean, actually,
do they really sleep in the traditional way?
Because a lot of birds migrate at night, so they can use whatever navigational skills they use. They're able to fly at night. navigating through woods and all is probably what's difficult for them. And at night, people aren't even 100% sure of all the things that they're using. They're using starlight. That's one reason that towers and all can really interrupt their migration and be a problem, because they get disoriented by that. So they do have the kind of vision that they need for migrating, but not for navigating around and feeding. And they need to sleep, too. So if they're active during the day.
Well, what would you say to people who just own, a little bit of property with a big yard and a bunch of, and they put bird feeders? What could they do to make sure the habitat stays
friendly? So the best thing to do is to, we have, our bird club has also published 2 books, and one of them is called Native Plants for Native Birds.
Mm.
So if you're going to do any planting at all, it would be good to investigate and find what plants are good for birds. We used to really focus on berry-bearing trees or trees and bushes, but more recently, there's more sophistication in this whole idea that you should also plant lots of things that attract insects, like, you know, moths, caterpillars, and all, so that they lay their eggs and then there's lots of caterpillars around. Because birds rely so much on this to feed their young. All birds, except for goldfinches, feed their young insect matter, even if they're seed eaters themselves.
Wow.
So it helps them to grow really quickly.
Mm-hmm.
So, so something like an oak tree can be a host to like 300 different kinds of caterpillars. So it's really important to know the kind of plants that grow in our area, what insects have co-evolved with them. Plant those and plant native berry bushes and things that give shelter. And actually, most of these things also give shelter. And then to have like a brush pile in the corner where they can forage. There's a lot of good stuff you can do.
You know, there's been a lot of talk and a lot of ink about the fact that so many domestic cats that are let
are
depleting some of our bird populations. Well, what does your club think about that?
Yeah, our club has a position that we encourage people to keep their cats indoors. The statistics, and it's, of course, it's all extrapolated, but that cats kill up to a billion birds a year, may seem exaggerated, but they do a lot of damage. Cat lovers say, too, it's better for the cats to stay inside.
Yeah.
But it requires you to be a more responsible pet owner if you keep them inside, because you need to keep them entertained and you need to make sure that they're stimulated. It's very easy to just let your cat go out and think, oh, they've had a nice day. But it's tough for birds. And I've had lots of cats that stalk my bird feeders, and I really don't like it. But
yeah, that's what we go through that up on West Hill, too. We keep our cats inside. Our cats are indoor cats. But we moved here from San Francisco. We always keep cats indoors.
Right, well, that's the thing. I'm from New York, too. I mean, the cats in New York City that were outdoors, they had a miserable life. I mean, they were always in horrible fights in the
night. Yeah, and getting run over.
Yeah, so, I mean, you know, it's a philosophical point, really. People like to see cats having a free life out there, but it's not the best thing for them. So.
Yeah.
Or the birds, or the little mammals that they kill. So.
What are you, and maybe you can speak for the bird club, but what do you think about people keeping birds in cages?
Well, I have actually caged birds at my house. I have two budgies, and I have a cockatoo. I have very mixed feelings. First of all, we're kind of spoiled in this country, because in this country, you can't just go out and catch any bird that you want and put it in a cage. But still, in many countries around the world, whatever bird pleases you, you can just go catch it and put it in a cage.
I
mean, that's really pretty horrible. I feel budgies are really almost domesticated in that they've been bred for so many generations. My little parakeets are out of the cage all day long. There's two of them. They're really happy with each other. And my cockatoo, when we're home with her, she's out of the cage. But I feel that the parrot trade is a horrible, horrible trade.
Yeah.
And most people do not keep their parrot. My kitchen cabinets are really chewed to pieces. We tolerate it. I mean, she's our bird for life. But many parrots live in 10 different homes in their lifetime and end up abandoned at a parrot rescue after all that.
So
it's really not a good idea, really. I mean, I think it's best to enjoy the birds where they are. Just do the best you can for them.
If
you have a cage bird, you should try to not keep it in the cage as much as possible. So,
But
I mean,
opposed to people doing that.
I mean, I don't have a strong, obviously, I don't. I love having birds around, and I've really had parakeets since I was little. I really never intended to get a parrot, but she was a gift to me, and I do love her, but I don't know anybody else that would put up with a parrot in the house. It's really, it's such an unnatural life for them, too. So
It's
tough.
So let's go back to our first part of our conversation. How do you get people interested in birds?
So let me just tell
the
you,
ones
though,
who
I mean,
don't even pay attention.
I mean, I don't know what to tell people that aren't at all interested, because maybe they just think that we're kind of nutty. But I think most people have like a basic interest in at least some kind of bird, if it's an eagle or if it's a great blue heron or something. So you would kind of find a way in like that, just talking to them. I often can see an eagle flying over Ithaca. Have you seen the eagle? I say to people even that are walking by. But otherwise, you cannot believe how many people show up for these bird walks at Sopsucker that are targeted toward beginners. I think that's the first thing, is to let people know that it's really okay to be a total beginner. Like, if you don't even know what a robin is, I don't care.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm just here to tell you what it is, you know. So even this past weekend, I showed up to lead the bird walk, and we had three people come, one young couple from Cornell. It was horrible weather. It was like 20-mile-an-hour winds. It felt like 10 degrees out. I thought nobody would come. They had never even looked at a bird. I said, do you have feeders? No, they had never. I don't even really. They never finished telling me why they came.
That's what I would
but
ask.
At the
yeah.
end, I said, what are you doing? But at the end, I said, please come back when it's nicer. They were excited. The birds that we saw, they loved. They took pictures. The young woman just had on these not waterproof boots, and she tolerated this hour of walking. So I don't know what brought them. I tried to get it out of them. I'm not sure they knew.
Yeah,
it's
yeah.
kind of like they were just looking for something to do.
Yeah, but it does bring people into the, you know, the natural world, and it's part of our world too.
Yeah.
We act. A lot of people act like that's not part of my world anymore.
Right.
I don't even have to pay attention to it. Yeah.
I mean, the best thing about it is that you don't have to go any place to look at a bird. You know, like I said, you can just be on.
Get
State
out of
Street.
Your car and look
yeah.
up, and
just
sometimes you'll see a beautiful
up.
Hawk.
Right.
I get so excited when I see hawks.
I know.
Yeah.
So, I mean, they're just around us. They are just part of what we do every day. They're pretty much on the same schedule we are. They're outdoing, they're eating and mating and flying yeah. when we're out and about.
And singing.
So, yeah, and singing.
Do birds sing when they're happy, or do they sing just because that's part of their makeup?
So singing is really their communication. And usually what they're communicating is that they're in pretty good shape, that they're fit, that they're looking for a mate, and that they have a territory. So that would imply that they're doing okay at that moment.
Uh-huh.
And actually, they've done studies where they play birdsong for people that are about to take a test, and they found that it really lowers their stress levels. And one thing I think is that humans and birds have been together for so long that when a human hears a bird singing, they realize that everything is pretty much okay in the world. There is not a predator around right now.
Yeah.
The weather is pretty okay. We're all okay. So the sound of birds singing makes us feel relaxed.
Yeah, that's why Rachel Carson called her book Silent Spring.
Yes, exactly.
Because that means that something is amiss.
Right, when you don't hear the sounds of nature, something is wrong. So happy is, you know, scientists don't like to say that a bird is happy, but I say they're doing okay if they're singing.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah. So, we only have a couple minutes left. Tell us how birds have entered your life and enriched it. Talk to us a little bit about that.
Well, so birds have entered my life and enriched it just because I mean, I have learned so much about, even just watching the seasons change as I've learned more about birds. I grew up in New York City, but I spent all my summers in a little tiny town in Massachusetts, so I've always loved nature. I wasn't taught to really observe what was happening on a seasonal basis. I don't really know how to describe this. Birds really taught me so much about the world that I'm living in. They made me notice when they're here, who's arriving, why is this happening. So I just have become more of a, not a nature person, but a part of nature because of
yeah,
them.
Yeah, it makes you feel more part of the world.
Right,
huh?
Right. So that in a sense, like, I don't have to make myself observe. I'm just part of the observation. I'm just in it.
Yeah.
So they've drawn me into that degree where I am not, I
you're
don't
not
feel
an
separate
outsider
from it.
Anymore. Yeah,
yeah, I feel like I'm in this world and a part of it. So that's a big thing for me.
Yeah. Well, Linda Orkin, we are almost out of time. Do you have some contact information? People get involved in birds,
yes,
get involved with
I
you guys?
I would love them to go to our website, which is cayugabirdclub.org. All of the officers' contact information is there. If anybody wants to get in touch with me, I'm the vice president, so it's wingmagic16@gmail.com. It's there. Our calendar is up there with the weekly bird walks at Sapsucker, plus our field trips. Everybody is welcome to come on any of these field trips, whether you're a member or not. We have once a month bird club meetings, which people are welcome to come to, and all that information is there.
So. Great, great. Well, Linda Orkin, thank you so much for joining us. I've been speaking with Linda Orkin, vice president of the Cayuga Bird Club. Thank you so much, and happy spring.
And thank you so much, Tish. I appreciate it.
Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega. And we are a sponsored project of the New York Foundation for the Arts. Tax-deductible donations are welcome at artspire.org. That's artspire.org. And visit us online at outoboundsradioshow.com. I'm Tish Perlman. We'll be back next week.